Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And we are
discussing one of the landmark judicial decisions made in the 20th century, Brown versus the Board of Education.
And why are we discussing this?
Because the anniversary is coming up. By the time we post this show, the anniversary of Brown would have passed on May 17th. So
65th anniversary, that is huge.
Child, that's a lot. So we are gonna dissect Brown because public schools continue to be a battleground for equity, even with the decision and all that has come from it. We think that people sometimes take for granted what Brown did and did not do. So we're just gonna review it. We're gonna jump right in. So this is one of our historical social justice. How do the Christians interact with this?
A lot of stuff with faith deals with education. Like, we definitely are uneducated in a lot of ways, and this is one of the major reasons why we're not just behind in education and how that relates to faith and then how that transfers to elections and things like that, as we're trying to understand and digest information, but it also relates to our standing in the world. And a lot of that is tied directly to this case.
This particular case. Let's just get right into it. So our racial history is convoluted, but one thing is very clear. At all times, we have always had a government that sought to meet the needs of various groups in inequitable ways. So after Civil War and Reconstruction, you have like this gray period for African Americans, for anybody who's not white, where who's not a white male, where now all of these supposedly free groups are trying to find their footing in this new American society. And Reconstruction, while promising, was something that was fought tooth and nail culturally as well as legislatively in the South, because you had this overwhelming idea that whites would not ever accept blacks and others as their equal in society as well as legally. They were not inclined to interact with these different groups as men and as women, you know, and treat, I'm going to treat you the same way I would treat my family, especially in front of the law. The problem with this is the Civil War amendments, which are our first test, our first attempt at civil rights. The 14th Amendment went dead at this, where it said everybody born in the United States is a citizen. This is where we get birthright citizenship from. But the other part of the 14th Amendment is equal protection before the law. You cannot go in front of a judge as a white man and a black man for the same charge. Now, this is going to sound crazy, but a white man's charged with murder and a black man's charged with murder, and the judge is not supposed to come to a conclusion within the law that ends up with the white man being treated differently for the same charge as the black man. So
you mean like if somebody had cocaine and somebody had crack?
Oh my goodness. It should be the same. Okay. So we obviously we've had issues with this because anything man-made is going to be imperfect. But the 14th Amendment is, it took us way further as far as testing whether or not we could ever wrangle what ended up being a very white supremacist government into one that could treat its citizens equitably. So as this is important for indigenous people who were going to interact with the United States. This is going to be important for new immigrant groups who are coming and who are seeking citizenship. Their children are being born here. And the overall idea is, am I an American? Can I be treated the way that you would treat the next American? So in the South, they fought it tooth and nail. They said, hell no. And as we do with most things politically and behind closed doors and being very strategic, Reconstruction ended abruptly and it ended artificially because basically Southern interests in Washington complained about the lack of honor that they were experiencing in getting reacclimated to the Union. And this is at a time where a white man's honor was more important than a black man's rights. So they negotiated an artificial end to Reconstruction that basically unleashed the worst inclinations in certain areas of the country. This is not to say that things didn't happen in the North. You now have people moving around who qualify for jobs, who are skilled artists citizens who need income. And now you have organizations who are discriminating in hiring and setting salaries because they just, this is an inequitable society. In 1896, we get a decision out of the Supreme Court with Plessy versus Ferguson that basically asked, if I am an American and I am using public facilities and have duly entered into contract to use these facilities, can I be expected to be treated? Contract meaning I bought a ticket, okay? So we know that Homer Plessy bought a train ticket. He was a man that was like 1/16th black, mm-hmm. and he bought a train ticket and he attempted to sit in a whites-only car because he appeared to be white, mm-hmm. and he was denied that seat. The case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, where basically they're saying, well, if you're riding through Louisiana, we reserve the right to treat you like we treat black folk in Louisiana, which is inequitably. That particular court said, we agree. From that, we get what?
Separate but equal.
We get separate but equal. So separate but equal is known by its trades name, which is Jim Crow laws, which basically saw the enshrinement of separate and very much unequal facilities.
Right. So the South seized on the separate.
Yes. They language. Said, finally, we don't have to interact with y'all. Right. We don't have to deal with y'all. We can treat y'all like trash. And we're going to treat you in a manner, not just in your interactions with formal institutions. Now we're talking about, why was the lunch counter in Greensboro important? Because separate but equal went all the way to how you eat your lunch, right. in public, and whether or not you're welcome in, you know, stores or someone's cafe. Death.
So they did it separate telephone booths. They did separate cemeteries.
Water fountains. Separate everything.
And for anyone who has been divorced, you know that once you separate two, like you have one house of income and then you separate that into two houses, you can't pay for everything the same
way. You're definitely not living the same as you were when it was all one. So it's the same thing. And when you're talking about tax dollars within a county, separate but equal, one of the ways that it most clearly showed itself was what these tax dollars were used for everybody who lives in a specific local area. So one of those things is education. So education is something that American government provides to its people, but it is not enshrined in the Constitution. It is something left to the states. So under Amendment 10 to the Constitution, everything that's not explicit there is left to the states. Education is one of those things, which is why we constantly have battles over curriculum, mm-hmm. over textbooks, over teacher standards, because every state can choose to agree to certain guidelines, but they can also deviate. They mm-hmm. can do different things, okay? Which is why, you know, being a teacher in New York City might not be as fulfilling as being a teacher in a rural county in Tennessee for different reasons, not just because the population is different, mm-hmm. but literally because people treat education and its provision to the people much differently.
So as the South started to separate everything to include the schools, states like Delaware, who built up to, by 1910, so this is Plessy versus Ferguson, is 1896. By 1910, they had built 81 schools for black children, but the schools were like dilapidated shacks, mm-hmm. and the students did not have a place to learn. There was a guy named Pierre DuPont who wanted to actually bring these schools up to code so that the students would have a chance. The South was against it. They said, no, we're not doing that. They had one black high school in the whole state of Delaware, mm-hmm. and this is the level of crowding that occurred in schools.
So these inequitable facilities, when you talk about how many schools are in a jurisdiction, when you talk about how much travel time it takes to get to a school. So you might be in a situation as a black student where you cannot go to the white school that is, you know, a 1 mile walk from your home. Your black school is a 6 mile walk from your home, and you are not allowed to go to the white school, which, you know, looks very nice and very welcoming. You're walking 6 miles to go to this shack. And Delaware being what Delaware is, not a bad place, but think about its location on the map. If you have 81 dilapidated schools in a state like Delaware, Imagine what you had in a state like North Carolina.
Yeah.
Imagine what you had in a state like Mississippi. So the upside, well, there's no real upside to this, but one of the more positive things that happens when things are separate, but are separate, we're not even going to talk about equality, is that they're self-contained. So while you had these examples of underfunding and bad facilities and lack of tools to educate young people, you also had a growing tradition of Black excellence that went from primary to secondary to possibly a collegiate level where our schools were for us. Okay. So you have these examples in certain cities like what is now known as Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
was a highly desired high school environment for Black children who had talent.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go from that school to a school like Howard. So where you, I'm always a big advocate of Black scholars being taken care of by Black scholars. So you had this development of a Black academia class that kind of came through mostly schools that were set aside for Black students. Those standards did not wane just because the facilities were unequal.
But so the fact that you do have people coming out of situations like that, the severity of the separation was so intense. So, for instance, in Prince Edward County in Virginia,
mm-hmm.
they did not have a high school in the state, in the county, until 1939. And so you got Blacks who, by 1947, that school was filled to twice the capacity of people who could be in the school. Atlanta did the same thing. They had overcrowded classrooms, decrepit buildings, things like that. They just didn't have the resources. And they attended school, like, in some cases, for half a day.
Mm-hmm.
And they had 3 hours a day. And in some of that time, it was just like singing and not a lot of education, just because they didn't have the resourcing and the teachers. So to come out of a situation like that, the crowding in Black schools, at one point, the national average was 82 students to one teacher. And in the same time in the white schools, it was 35-1.
Right.
So that is an incredible amount of competition for attention, just to learn basic things.
And you had, these are situations that put young people at risk. So at this particular time, we don't have a compulsory education law that says that young people have to stay in school until 16, mm-hmm. until the age of 16. And this was not just relegated to our race, this risk of coming out of school before completing certain requirements. But imagine being in a situation where you are suffering through poverty, man-made poverty, and just poverty that you find yourself living in, and you reach an age where you can work. We don't have child labor. Like, it's a perfect storm. We don't have child labor protection laws at the beginning of the 20th century. We are still largely an agrarian society. We're moving into an economy that is more automated. Factories and creating materials and creating products, because we're after the Civil War, you would think that everybody just stopped working in the fields, but we didn't. Like, you have sharecropping, and sharecropping was just one shade off of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So you had people treating the ability to go to school as a privilege, but they are pulling their children out, or people are feeling like they have to come out because they have to go to work.
Yeah.
So it becomes an untenable situation.
And so it's impossible for the states to build two comparable systems, two separate but equal systems. So the NAACP gets involved and starts to bring through legislation cases against the Southern governments who were incapable of meeting the standards in Plessy. And so you end up with this collection of cases.
Unwilling.
Unwilling to meet the standards in Plessy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all the way through 1950. So then cases start to come up from Delaware, Virginia, South Carolina, Kansas, and D.C.
Mm-hmm.
They get bundled up into one case in 1952, argued by Thurgood Marshall. This is the Brown versus Board of Education.
Yes. So Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, has to do with a man named Oliver Brown, who filed a class action lawsuit. And you know, a class action allows for other people who are suffering under the same circumstances to join your lawsuit under the guise of two is stronger than one. Okay. On behalf of his daughter, Linda Brown, they filed a lawsuit against the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas in 1951 because she was denied entry into that district's all-white elementary schools. This was a case about proximity. There was a school that was closer to her home that her dad attempted to enroll her in, and he was denied. He was told that she would have to go to a school that was meant for Black children. But that school did not have facilities, was not equipped to educate her. This became the test case. Upon the denial, that's where your case comes from. So taken together, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Thurgood Marshall worked for them. He worked with a team of attorneys, and they began to prepare to present what ultimately became known as Brown 1 to the Supreme Court. Now, mm-hmm. something happens between 1952 and 1954.
So I don't know what you're talking about, but I know that between that time, mm-hmm. they started to prepare for this decision. And so what they did was they started actually repairing some of the Black schools. They started building Black schools and allowing money to go through to build the schools because they want Thurgood Marshall to withdraw this from the Supreme Court docket. Mm-hmm. And so you get this brief period between 1952 and 1954 where it looks okay. Mm-hmm. It looks like things are getting better.
Starting to look better.
Right. So Carol Anderson, in her book, White Rage, she has a passage that it really kind of shows us. She says, when it was clear that the carrot, which is them letting Black schools actually come up a little bit, when it was clear that the carrot wouldn't work, and when even once reliable Negroes, whom the power structure had always been able to count on to preach patience, actually refused to lend their support to equalization schemes to convince the NAACP to withdraw Brown from the Supreme Court docket, then the response was emphatic. So they are trying to placate the Negroes that'll mm-hmm. be like, hey, just give them a chance. They look like they're doing something. Mm-hmm. But this was a strategy on their part.
Who had always been reliable. That's telling. Yeah. That's telling.
Yeah. We got some of those now, but go ahead.
We gonna keep them. What I am speaking of is the makeup of the court actually changes. Okay. So at the time of the building up of the cases and they're rising through the appellate and they're finally going to go in front of the Supreme Court. In 1952, the court has a different chief justice. So during this period of trying to make it look better, mm-hmm. there's a chief justice who is of the mind. His name is Fred Vinson, but he's of the mind that Plessy should stand and that state should, you know, be given this opportunity to bring them up. But that desegregation is not the answer, that separate but equal can work. And, you know, I don't want to speak for him, but from his very important seat, he did not have or did not appear to have the foresight that a court could not be divided on such an important issue. Mm-hmm. He actually passes away in 1953, which gives President Eisenhower an opportunity to appoint a new chief justice. Mm-hmm. Now, we've seen in the last couple of elections how important these SCOTUS seats are. So the Supreme Court of the United States, how important these seats are. They are important because once you put somebody on there, they could die there. Mm-hmm. They do not have to retire. They don't have to leave. Okay. And when they leave, it could either be by retirement or by death. They don't have to step aside. So we've seen where increasingly we have people who rise to the court that we think are certain ideologies. Mm-hmm. We have 9 seats on that court. So when you get split decisions, 5-4 either way, sometimes you get 6-3s, but when you get 5-4 either way, that means that there's a swing vote. There's somebody there who has interpreted the law and tested the Constitution and says, I don't think it should go to the left. I think it should go to the right. Mm-hmm. And this Chief Justice Vinson, he wasn't going to be the swing vote on his previous court. What Warren was able to do with his political astuteness, because he had been a previous governor of California, was that he had foresight. And he said, this is not something that history is going to be kind to you. We have had leaders who have had vision to understand that history will be unkind in its review of your actions. So what Warren did that Vinson might not have been able to do was not only did he orchestrate a decision that really reviewed the purpose and the intent of the 14th Amendment, but he also ensured that none of his justices come up on the wrong side of history.
So leading into this decision, mm-hmm. what the states are doing is at some point they're anticipating that this may not go their way. And so a state like Mississippi actually shut down its public schools. They crafted an amendment to abolish public schools, which denied black children, 325,000 black children, education. Mm-hmm. Louisiana did the same thing. Georgia, they channeled their state funds, and this is important. They took their state funds for their public schools and diverted them to private schools.
Mm-hmm. And what does that sound like?
Right. So we're going to get to that. So that move in Georgia ahead of Brown was 321,000 black children mm-hmm. without education. Now, keep in mind, when you do this, there's white students that end up being collateral damage.
Always.
Because you can't target black students like that and not get anyone else. So these are the numbers for the black students. I don't have the numbers for the white students, but we do know that there was a large contingent of poor white students who could not afford to get into those private schools that were also impacted by this. And then we get to May 17th, 1954.
Okay. So as we said, this Kansas case was combined with other plaintiffs as a class action, and it came to be known as what we call Brown versus the Board. In his decision, Warren orchestrated a unanimous verdict that ultimately overturned Plessy. So even though we're talking about schools, this was the first domino to fall to kind of undo decades and over a century, actually, of unrest around how do we treat African Americans who have a free condition. So in a decision issued on May 17, 1954, Chief Justice Warren wrote that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place, as segregated schools are inherently unequal. As a result, the court ruled that plaintiffs were being deprived of the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment.
And in a D.C. case, you also had the violation of the due process clause of the 15th Amendment, but that was just the D.C. case. So everything else was, including D.C., was the equal protection of under the 14th. D.C. had that other component because remember, they rolled the cases together.
So a second case known as Brown Part 2, which came down in 1955, remanded or sent all future challenges to this decision to lower courts as well as local jurisdictions so that they could decide how best to implement this new precedent, this new decision. So this is sometimes what the Supreme Court does. They will make a legal decision. They will not always give you a plan. So the Supreme Court right now, they're looking at redistricting. They can look at gerrymandering and say that's unconstitutional, but they might send it back to the state legislature to fix it. They're not going to tell you how to do it, and which creates a whole nother ball of problems. And that is exactly what happened here. So by not implementing an actual desegregation plan, we had residual effects to the Brown decision.
Yeah. So between Brown 1 and Brown 2, you have Emmett Till, because the violence ratcheted up a lot after this. Then you also had attacks on voter registration. So the number of blacks registered to vote went down in Mississippi by 2/3 between this time. And the reason why was because you didn't want blacks voting in the states, in the state elections, because the states now are positioned to speak against the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So after Brown 2, you have states like Mississippi and South Carolina declaring Brown unconstitutional. And so South Carolina specifically wants to secede. And you have states doing their own thing because they don't want to adhere to the guidelines of Brown versus Bull.
And this is where I would just like to bring up the fact that my dad was born in 1937. My mom was born prior to Brown, and they are still alive. So we are not talking about, you know, forward scored 100 million years ago.
This is our parents' generation. Yeah. So my dad was alive when Brown came down. Mm-hmm. And so the fighting that ensued after Brown went on for decades.
Yes.
Through some say the 70s. But when you talk about students who will walk 6 miles just to get an education, like my kids go 30 miles to a school just to get the education that they can't get locally. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we could say it ended in the 70s, but I don't know because we still see some of the effects of Brown. So 1955, you have the Brown 2 decision. And it's and basically says that desegregation must happen with all deliberate speed. Mm-hmm. And then that's when the states start to yell, no, this is unconstitutional. Right. We're going to do
we
our own thing.
We don't want to. States' rights.
Georgia passed an amendment, a state resolution to repeal the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendment.
I bet they did. But this was why it was important for this particular court to be unanimous behind the constitutionality of the 14th and 15th Amendment, because foresight will tell you that the challenges are coming and you have to understand what type of political handiwork got us to that point. There's a lot of compromises. We got into a whole civil war because of compromises, not even because of laws, but because of making exceptions to our laws. This was not going to be anything different. So one of the things that that was a residual effect is that now everybody is well aware of public funds going into public education and this idea that those educations need to be equitable. Mm-hmm. So if my child is living in any town USA in this particular county and they go to their elementary, their middle, and their high school, that should be equitable to Susie Q's child living in other town USA in the neighboring county, her child going to that elementary, middle school, and high school. They should have teachers who meet the same qualification standards, buildings that have the same safety codes and the same access, you know, points and the same safety standards. You should have equipment. You shouldn't go to a Susie Q school and it's fully wired and they have internet and they have, you know, money for arts and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But at my school, the best we have is YouTube and you have to access it on your phone and right. things of this nature.
So right before Brown, there was some research done on how much the school systems were spending for white students and black students. Mm-hmm. And in Louisiana, the average spend across the state was $76 for white students and $23 for black students. Mm-hmm. In one of their parishes, I believe East Feliciana Parish, it was $121 for white students and $18 for black students. Now, what happens is after Brown 2, states start to and school districts start to shut down.
Yep.
In Little Rock, Arkansas, they shut down their city schools and then they let people donate to a fund. So what they did, they gave a tax credit for people who donated to this education fund to fund private schools
yes.
at $176 per student. They argued that this is not taking any tax
right,
revenue
because
from schools.
These are people making donations.
Right. But if they're making tax deductible donations, that money is not being paid as tax, and which means the school funding goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the type of things that they did after Brown
to try to circumvent it,
right?
To try to undermine it, try to circumvent it. Now, one of these things is called a segregation academy. Okay. Segregation academies pop up when school districts are shutting down their public schools or they're anticipating that their schools are ultimately going to be desegregated. A segregation academy was where you set up a private school, whether it had a religious affiliation or not, and you set the criteria such that it began to exclude students that you didn't want there. The idea behind that was that it's private. So as a private entity, it should be able to say no blacks allowed, because it's private and it's using private funds. We mentioned earlier that sometimes poor whites get caught up as collateral damage. This is no different. What they began to do is offer scholarships for those people whose honor, as you know, as white Americans, would not allow them to be educated in the same building as possibly African American students. Now understand, in 2019, this is what it would look like to be educated in a building full of minority students. So you wouldn't just say African Americans, you would say, you know, like there's a high school in Virginia where some parents made a big fuss because they feel like their kids don't perform as well as their Asian American counterparts. that to me is neither here nor there. But if those parents, if they understood the arc of argument that they were engaging in, they would be advocating for extracting their white student to go to an all-white school so that that student can now outperform their peers. It's when they get mixed in that they feel like they don't get a fair shot. And this is not just in that particular jurisdiction in Virginia. There are a number of examples of high-performing students who feel like, I can't do it. You know, or families who are just like, I can't do it, and I'd rather skew the playing field. This scandal that we, you know, that's going through the news now, it hasn't died yet as far as people paying for seats for their students to go to these elite schools. That really comes from the fact that you're buying clout, but you're buying clout because your kid doesn't have the grades. Period. You know what I mean? And when you think about all that goes into ensuring that a student has the grades, especially under bootstrap philosophy, the idea is you have equal access to a school. You've gotten this great education. You should be able to get to Stanford on your own. That is not fair to, you know, the student who actually accomplishes that, you know, to the one whose dad or whose mom has a couple million dollars, you know, laying around because they want that Stanford degree. Yeah. And once you do that, that's a slippery slope. I really have issues with what has happened with, you know, in the college game. But it happens. These ideas are rooted somewhere. It's this idea, I don't have to compete. I can do something right. else.
So what happens is this goes on for a while. And then 10 years after Brown, Supreme Court has another set of cases, Griffin versus the school board of Prince Edward County in Virginia. And they ruled that they need that the school's district needs to implement desegregation. Mm-hmm. And so this was 1964. By 1969, this county, which was highly segregated, Prince Edward County in Virginia, which is the state down just below from where mm-hmm. we are, was 98% black. This started in prior to 1954 with the Jim Crow laws, mm-hmm. and then through 1954 Brown, and then the decades following effects of Brown versus Board of Education. So for four decades, the end result is that the United States has millions of citizens who lack the education to compete in these global markets. Mm-hmm. Because what happened in 1964 when schools started to actually desegregate, I mean, it was so nuts. Delaware had implemented a 12-year delay in implementing Brown. That's part of their legislation. So by the time they got around to it, those factory jobs and automation jobs mm-hmm. that you had mentioned, those were like high school only jobs, but those had been drying up. So now you need to get a college degree to be able to compete. And now black people and a lot of this collateral damage is being just stuck in this high school. They just got to high school. And mm-hmm. you're saying we move the goalposts again. And you now gotta get to college.
So, and the way you access college is through the GI Bill. And so we just have this long history of examples of when you think about what welfare is, you know, it's an assistance from the government to meet your basic needs. As you keep pushing the goalposts back, though, you've decided, our basic needs are college education. So if you went to the Army and you might not have finished high school before you even went to the Army, we'll pay for you to go to college. We'll pay for you to enter into this new middle class. You don't want to live in the cities anymore because that's where a lot of this social change is happening. We will build the suburbs for you. As a matter of fact, we'll build highways so that you can drive away from these more desegregated areas or these blacker areas mm-hmm. and you can go drive out to the county, wherever that is, even where we're based at right now. This used to be a bastion of segregationist type activities. Even if DC itself was a chocolate city, this particular county was not, you mm-hmm. know, everything surrounding it was not. One thing that when we talk about residuals, Brown is in 54. You have Meredith versus Mississippi in 62, which takes the Brown ideal and applies it to public universities. Okay. Now we know this was not peaceful. So even if you see that Brown is happening with primary and secondary schools, James Meredith had been applying. He had attended a HBCU in Mississippi, but he wanted to graduate from Ole Miss. And he had been applying to Ole Miss every year and been denied. He'd also been in the Army, so he was an older student. Long story short, that was found to be unconstitutional because ultimately what? Public universities draw public funds. They draw taxpayer funds through the legislature. And him attempting, he won his case, but in attempting to enroll, there was a riot on campus. So there are always these examples of white rage against black progress. And that is what it is. And you got to say that in whole language. You can't really sugarcoat that because that's what it is. There's this history to be contended with. After Meredith, or actually prior to that, you have the Montgomery bus boycott, which is testing this separate but equal doctrine. You keep trying to have it in these certain areas. You don't want to let it go. Economically, they got crushed and they said, okay, y'all can ride the buses. But that was, it was not about moving your seat on a bus. It was about whether or not you, your African-American dollar, is it worth what a white man's dollar is worth? That is what the point was proven. Brown, Meredith, Brown 2, Montgomery bus boycott lead to Civil Rights Act 64. That leads to the Voting Rights Act of 65. Which ultimately leads to the Housing Rights Act of 68. This idea of not in my backyard. People always want good things for other people, but they don't want it where they live at. Mm-hmm. Okay. That idea is not limited to any race of people. It is hard, and it's not really relegated to any class of people, but there are certain class of people who have a little bit more power in what goes on in their neighborhood than others. Okay. So that being understood, what Brown actually provided the basis for is this phenomenon called white flight. Brown opened the door and Housing Rights Act of 68 said, oh, F it, because now it is unlawful to discriminate on where African Americans live based on their race. So imagine you've been having issues with education. You're selling to your kids that education is the way up. It's going to free you. It's going to open more doors for you. You are working in probably terrible conditions. You, up until a certain point, you belong to a black union. Mm-hmm. That black union doesn't have the same bargaining power at your organization, at your company, as the white union does. The whites don't want to see you get an extra quarter per hour. But whatever you've been able to scrape together, now you're ready to buy your little house, okay? You're ready to buy your house. So you want to go to your local Levittown because this is where you want to make an investment. And one of the things that you're looking to benefit from is access to better schools because things have not changed that much. Mm-hmm. So you want to go to Levittown High School as opposed to, you know, Old East Side High, because Levittown High School is not only bigger and nicer, but it's been bigger and nicer for longer. And you think that that is going to be the key to your upward mobility. White flight occurred when black families began to be able to access their areas economically. So now I can afford to live in your Levittown. And armed with Housing Rights Act of 68, you can't tell me no, because my, you know, $10,000 for my 3-bedroom house is just as good as yours. We now, having hindsight, can look back and see how many different entities conspired to make sure that that was a slow growth, make sure that that was slow, a slow amount of change. Because what? Economics is economics is economics. People don't always have money to put their kids in private school. They can't keep doing that. They can't keep moving, okay? It's easier to shut you out than to pick up and leave. But by and large, there's a whole generation of African Americans who remember being the first and everybody leaving. This is how a lot of areas turned African American. Even where we record, we began to leave DC and Baltimore. This became a hub because of our major employer. That employer built up a black middle class.
So even like when you think through gentrification and things like that, so DC wasn't always Chocolate City. There was a lot of white people there. There was white flight out of DC.
And
so
there
what
were
happened,
areas that are now white that were black.
Yeah. So the areas like where I live and further out and away from DC, that was where that flight landed. And so what happens is,
exactly. So at some point, you want to come back.
So now we had back out been on that we got Facebook.
So anyway, that's the And it's a cycle, and of course we've touched on it before, and we'll touch on it again. But these are the residuals; these are the things that we are still dealing with, because ultimately, you know, there's always a battle, whether it's around an election or an issue about public education. So the way Brown looks in modern times is this idea of moving public funds to fund private education. And we are not teachers, nor are we education executives, but we are thinking and observing people. And it's very, very clear that the energy that is currently leading the Department of Education, for example, is a strong advocate of things called, they seem so innocuous, school choice. Voucher programs, right?
Education Freedom Scholarship.
Blah, blah, blah. This is a ruse to move taxpayer dollars into private educational entities. Another thing that was spawned out of this that I just want to mention, when you say, you know, how does this interact with this Christian community? Homeschooling. This idea that you're not going to get this rigid worldview out of your public schools. A lot of people decided to not participate at all. And in not participating at all, which is ultimately your right in a country like this. But the pioneers of the people who did it probably had it the hardest, because now you have local jurisdictions that do send some sort of funding to people who homeschool, and they have, it's grown. And it's something that, again, people of all races and all religions can participate in. But when you talk about how did it become popular, who, you know, pushed it out as a viable alternative to public education, it's a lot of people who are rooted in these segregationist ideas, as far as under the guise of Christianity, under the guise of saying, I want my child to have a more Christian focused education. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really that. It was that they did not want an education that would be impacted or influenced by other worldviews.
Yeah. And it's also who can afford to homeschool, because somebody has to be home.
Somebody
to do
has
it.
To stay home.
So that means somebody's making enough money for everybody to be home in either teaching or in school. The reason why we went through a lot of the examples specifically of shuttering whole school districts and diverting the money into private schools is because that is the same playbook that's being run right now. In terms of the current Department of Education in their voucher program, they do want to cut federal funding to these schools, but they want to build up the charter schools or these other schools that are restricted. So I said, I send my kids 30 miles away from my house, because that's the charter school that they got into. And you feel guilty because, you know, I try to do the best thing for my kid, but also I know this hurts the county because everyone doesn't have access to this opportunity.
It's a false choice. It's a false choice, because if you understand what's going on, then you do want to invest your child in their very best opportunity to get educated. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that parents need to be aware of, that emotionally, during these elections and times to make decisions, people play your emotions against your long-term interests. I'm not saying that charter schools are not good. What I am saying is you also have to be sure of the product that you're going to get, because they've gotten better. There are some schools that have been innovative and have been engaging and have added value to the educational landscape. But again, we're not saying that that's not impossible. We're talking about the history of where they come from. And we're not the only ones who are aware of this, mm-hmm. okay? So people have been talking about school choice, at least from what I've understood about it, probably maybe not when I was in high school, but I'll give you the last 20 years. So in the last 20 years, I've heard a lot more about charter schools, innovative education programs, companies funding what they call innovative educational programs. They don't want the interference from local jurisdictions and the bureaucracy and all this drama. Really, without that bureaucracy, sometimes you don't have a balance and a check to what information is being delivered to your kid.
Your offer and discrimination comes back very quickly in those services. Because now, once you get rid of the checks, then you could dictate who goes to that school and who cannot. And so,
and what the standards are for that school, and these standards don't really have to match the charter schools in the next jurisdiction.
Right. So all charter schools are not equal. And no, the reason why my kid's school is that far out is because I skip a lot of charter schools to get there. Like, we're lucky to get in there. But again, if everyone in the county doesn't have access to the same opportunities, then how does this county succeed? We mentioned before that they rolled into the tax credits that they gave for people who donated to the scholarship fund. This administration is also saying it's tax credits for individuals and companies who donate money to a nonprofit scholarship fund. The playbook has not changed.
It hasn't.
And if you look at the decades-long fight that went around in and around Brown and what that did to us, we fell behind in the world in technology. Mm-hmm. That's why our elections are susceptible the way they are. We fell behind in industries. Mm-hmm. We are behind in clean energy. People are outpacing us. Engineering, hard sciences, we are behind because we fought for decades to target Black people. We ended up sweeping in all these other people, and we have an uneducated or undereducated.
White supremacy eats its children.
Every time.
Okay, it eats its kids, and this is no different. Poor whites are suffering again. And when you say the playbook has not changed, neither has the blame game. Okay, so it's very, very easy to say you're not experiencing economic upward mobility because of somebody trying to get into your country. That is basically an easier pill to swallow than to understand that possibly you're in a state or in a local jurisdiction that has been working against your interests since before you were born because of who else lives there. The high school educated people, they are thriving in that we need people for trades. But when you say we fell behind, that was the price that was willing to be paid for nothing other than supremacy. That's the only thing that's benefited from it. And even right now, people are having a hard time accepting the critique that Americans are not at the top of certain industries or at the top of production of consumable, not even consumable products, but like consumable culture. Like, I don't think people understand what the fall of an empire looks like. Mm-hmm. But when you begin to undereducate your people, I think this is what Warren understood that possibly Justice Vinson did not. Ultimately, all of these young Americans are going to power this economy. Mm-hmm. Ultimately. So why would I want half of them to be illiterate?
Right. So not that we deserve one, but if we were to look for a silver lining, the same tactic that undereducates your citizenry through this white supremacist view of reducing or eliminating access to education, and then you also get all these other people, you can flip that. If you provide education to the
gratuitously
least, you will catch.
And get rid of our student loans. Amen. Okay, go ahead.
You will catch the other people. And so the way to come up is to flip the play and say, we're going to run this on the other side now. We're going to actually do something that is the right thing that should have been done a long time ago, mm-hmm, that we tried to do and fought so hard against. We're going to do that thing and see how we flourish after that, because it is not too late to turn it around. But right now we seem to be going down the same path.
Yeah.
So we have an opportunity. Election's coming.
How y'all going to act?
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.